I want to get a little bit of take out of you guys about Herceptin, and then Bill has a premenopausal patient. So first, let's start with Dennis.
53-year-old Caucasian female teacher, Gravita 3, Para 3, who in September of 2002 was perimenopausal, felt the left breast mass. Her physician felt a firm, mobile 8 to 10 centimeter mass occupying most of the breast. Interestingly enough, a mammogram showed a dense breast with no area of suspicion. She had a core biopsy, which showed a poorly differentiated carcinoma with both ductal and lobular features, ER 85%, PR 45%. HER2 was 2+ by DACO and 5.4 by FISH. This was sent out to EMPATH. Breast MRI, incidentally, showed a large, irregular, heterogeneous mass with suspicious axillary node involvement. She had a very strong family history of breast cancer. Mother died at age 62. Maternal aunt died at age 60. Maternal first cousin diagnosed at age 60. No family history of ovarian cancer. Incidentally, genetic testing done later showed a BRCA2 mutation, which was not previously defined as one of the BRCA2 mutations.
Anything else you want to say about this woman, what her lifestyle was, what she was doing at the time?
Great lifestyle. She was actually a supervisor of a math department at one of the local independent schools. Very active. 3 kids, great children, very involved with the community.
Otherwise healthy?
Otherwise very healthy.
And staging is negative?
Staging is otherwise negative.
So, Skip, we have a 53-year-old woman with locally advanced breast cancer that's ER-positive and HER2-positive by FISH. What are your thoughts about how you'd approach her today?
Aggressively. I think this would be a patient that would get, in my clinic, from what I've heard, TCH, get docetaxel, carboplatin, Herceptin for 3 cycles, and Herceptin with it, and I'd make a decision at that point about whether we're going to be able to go to surgery or do some sort of other local modality. I think based on the degree of response and how it goes, there still seems to be a tremendous benefit for an anthracycline in these patients, short of the subset where we can maybe find out about topo testing. So thinking down the line, maybe postoperatively getting an anthracycline and then finishing out Herceptin for a year after completion of that. So that style of therapy. But I think I'd go best first response rate driven with HER2 regimen. I'm not comfortable with the MD Anderson regimen yet with the FEC, with the cardiotoxicity. So it'd be TCH for 3 cycles for starters.
And what would you be thinking about in terms of hormone therapy? She's ERPR positive and she's perimenopausal.
I would feel almost certain I'd have her postmenopausal by the time I'd be done with my treatment and be looking at 5 years of an AI for starters.
Dan, how would you approach her?
Very similarly, except that we haven't been using TCH. So we would probably just do it the old-fashioned way and give her AC times 4 dose stents, which is 2 months. It's almost over before you start it. And then a taxane with Herceptin, again, 4 times dose stents, and then do her surgery and then chest wall radiotherapy and then put her on an AI and keep her on trastuzumab. But I wouldn't argue with what you're doing either. I think these are just, you know, institutional differences.
Would you argue with somebody who would use the Buzdar regimen using concurrent trastuzumab and an anthracycline?
Well, I think had I been at MD Anderson when they designed that trial, I would have argued about it. It's a pretty risky trial, I thought. But they pulled it off, and the data are the data. It is hard for a lot of us to believe that epirubicin is that much safer than doxorubicin in terms of heart disease. I would say in a community setting, you're pushing your luck, and there are other ways to treat this lady without exposing her to that kind of risk, with only a small number of women being treated that way. I agree with you. I think this is risky business.
Can we just fast forward? Let's go up to 2005 when she gets to Memorial.
So we gave her 4 cycles of AC up front, Mark cytoreduction reduction at her breast. Post-op, she had dose dense Taxol, because that's just when the dose dense data hit, and she was put on tamoxifen. So 2 years later, actually in the spring of 2005, when the Herceptin data hit, we went through a long discussion of what to do at this point in time because she was still perceived to be at very high risk. So we obtained a second opinion. It's Sloan Kettering.
Did you mention the fact she had the mastectomy and the 1 positive node?
Yeah, mastectomy, 1 positive node. So pre-op AC, mastectomy, post-op, dose dense, Taxol, put on tamoxifen.
Did she have residual cancer in her breast?
4 centimeters, but with a marked treatment effect with inflammation and fibrosis.
So the question here is, delayed trastuzumab. This would now be 3 years after initial diagnosis of locally advanced disease. Would you offer trastuzumab at this point? Skip?
No. I think that it's a tough decision. I've just sort of pick 6 months for my typical patient. I've been at 8 months for somebody that was really young and I was worried about, and I just haven't gone past that point. I think I could see the debate up to a year, but no, I probably wouldn't.
Dan?
Yes, but I struggle with this. And it's an area in which we'll never have data because the window will close by the time we could get a trial up and running, because in 2-3 years, everyone will get it up front. So we're never going to have an answer. But so let me give you my logic, Skip, and see if you... One is that trastuzumab in the metastatic setting versus no trastuzumab prolonged survival in the Sleiman trial. And a lot of the women who were on the no trastuzumab actually got trastuzumab later. So that was an early versus late trial in the metastatic setting with a modest but statistically significant survival benefit. Two is this lady had a bad prognosis to begin with and is in the middle of her highest risk of recurrence time, between 2 and 6 years. So she's still at substantial risk of recurrence. And so if trastuzumab improves survival in the metastatic setting, and if it improves survival in the early adjuvant setting, which I now believe we have data to support, it's unbelievable to me to think that it would not improve the odds of her survival by giving it at 2 years. Having said that, it's not evidence-based, and you're right. The randomized trials, when they broke the code, went back and said, if you're 6 months or less, you should get it. If you're more than 6 months, you shouldn't. That made no sense to me at all. And so I've been pretty aggressive with these folks because the results are absolutely consistent across 5 studies now with a 50% reduction in distant mets, and there's a reduction in mortality in every study, some of them way not statistically significant because there's so few deaths in some of them. But as you know, in the combined intergroup NSABP, there is a survival benefit that's statistically significant. And it just would be hard for me to look this lady in the eye and suggest she should not receive trastuzumab for at least a year at this point.
So can you follow up with what happened when she got to Memorial?
So what happened to Memorial, they rechecked her HER2 status, and she was not amplified. And I've had this happen a number of times, this fragmentation between labs where there are both false negatives and false positives.
So she was FISH 5.4 by Empath, and then she goes to Memorial and they say she's FISH negative.
So can I address that one for sure? Again, I chair the ASCO Tumor Marker Guidelines Committee. We have been quite concerned about not just whether you should use a test or not, but whether the assay is reliable. And frankly, HER2 is getting a lot of press, but ER is equally bad. We are now putting together a joint effort with the College of American Pathologists, who have spent more time worrying about how the assays are done and not whether they should be done. So hopefully we'll have the two interests together. That's just beginning to happen. We're going to have meetings this spring, specifically starting with HER2. We all agree it should be done, and the question is there a best way to do it? And if so, within each of the assays, are there best ways to do it? This is not an uncommon story. There's all this information that immunohistochemistry is inconsistent, but so is FISH. And the reason FISH was relatively consistent up front was because there were only 2 or 3 people doing it. And if you do it all the time, you're really good. But as we start to spread FISH out to people who don't do it all the time, there's going to be heterogeneity. It's not an easy test.
Which assay is correct?
There's no right or wrong.
In this patient?
Any positive.
So what I would do with this lady, 2 things. I would probably go 2 out of 3, send another one to the Mayo Clinic, where I think they really do know how to do it right. And again, I would over-treat this lady rather than under-treat her. In my opinion, the benefits are so substantial, and the risk, granted, there's the heart failure business, but the risks are relatively small, and her risk of relapse is pretty high.
I've heard the statement made that perhaps tests like the Oncotype DX actually will end up providing better ER and HER2 data.
Part of our collaborations are to negotiate with a company to open the veil so you can actually see the individual genes. And again, one of the reasons I like the Oncotype DX is it's semi-quantitative. It's much more quantitative than IHC, which is awful. FISH is relatively quantitative, but it doesn't tell you about the protein. Of course, it tells you about the gene. And Oncotype DX tells you about the RNA, which you think is a step closer to where you're working. So we would hope that that's the case. And if we would fund the NIH a little better, we could move along a little faster. Can I throw one other thing out?
Sure.
I was at an aromatase inhibitor meeting this summer, and Ian Smith set up a very similar case, and Skip, you sort of brought it up, because he said, let me tell you a story. A young woman was 40 years old, got chemotherapy, became amenorrheic, put her on TAM, was ER positive, didn't have a period for 5 years. After 5 years, switched her to letrozole, still didn't have a period, called me up after about 10 or 11 months of letrozole and said, Dr. Smith, I need a pregnancy test. And he said, well, you don't need a pregnancy test. You haven't had a period in, what is it now, 5 or 6 years. And besides that, you're on a drug that suppresses estrogen production. You can't be pregnant. And she said, Dr. Smith, have you ever been pregnant? And he said, no. And she said, well, I have been, and I need a pregnancy test. And besides that, I'm looking at a website that says that gynecologists are using aromatase inhibitors to induce ovulation in anovulatory women to make them pregnant. So Dr. Smith said, can you give me that URL? And he has now gone back, he's at the Royal Marsden, and just done a survey of, I can't remember, 40 or 50 women that we've submitted to JCO now. And it turns out that about a third of women who were pre- or perimenopausal before they got chemotherapy and become amenorrheic had a reawakening of their ovaries in one way or another with the addition of an AI. And biologically, it makes sense. You're dropping estrogen levels even lower for a temporary period of time. You jack up the LHFSH system, and a sleeping ovary can wake up again. So we're going to publish guidelines for actually doing serial hormone monitoring. They're rather arbitrary because there are no data out how often or when you should do these. But the real point here is if you start an AI, you should be sure that your patient remains postmenopausal, that her estrogen levels stay below 20 or so. And you may find a few patients who jack up. I've already seen at least two in my own practice go up to 200 or 300 of estrogen levels after without having a period.